please remember to press star 6 to mute your line so that we can avoid any background noise as we're getting started today. So we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome to the 2025 Yukon River In-Season Salmon Management Teleconference. Your participation is essential to our discussions on managing the Yukon River's vital salmon runs. I am Olivia Hanahi Irwin, Policy Coordinator at the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, and I will be your host this meeting. We will cover key topics such as run assessments, environmental conditions, management strategies, and stakeholder feedback. We thank our funding partners, the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission and Panama Chiefs Conference, for their support. These teleconferences facilitate communication across the 2,200-mile Yukon River, enabling fishermen, processors, researchers, managers, and others to exchange real-time information and engage in effective salmon management discussions. Originally designed to bridge communication gaps, these calls now require significant reconstruction due to the declining salmon run. While maintaining that original purpose, we aim to make these calls a platform for actionable feedback, providing insights and recommendations to management entities. We will restructure the format, topics, and feedback mechanisms to ensure that these calls contribute to tangible improvements in fisheries management and provide updates on Yukon River research. We appreciate your feedback and concerns about salmon declines. We will focus on developing solutions to these calls. In the 2025 preseason meeting, tribal representatives discussed threats to salmon and identified potential solutions, and we will guide the conversation in a solution-oriented manner. We would like to welcome all the new callers and new board members as well. We encourage young fishers to participate in these calls to learn and engage in Yukon River fisheries. The YRDFA in-season subsistence salmon survey is currently up and running. We thank the National Park Service and NOAA for funding the program this year. We are working on rolling out a digital app version of the program and will update you when it's ready. We want to encourage fishers in the in-season survey communities to reach out to their local surveyor and share what they are seeing on the river. This program is a way for fishers to anonymously share their observations as well as their concerns or challenges with managers. I ask that all participants today please be respectful and thoughtful to one another. This space is to be used as a communication tool between all users of the Yukon River. By working together, we can foster positive outcomes when we support one another. And Abase for all of your time and participation. I want to remind everybody to please remember to press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. If you are using the mute feature on your phone, you will still need to press star 6 to mute and unmute. Okay. Thank you for sitting through that. Welcome to those who have not been in our teleconference before, and welcome back to those who have. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to ask if there are any media on the line to please announce themselves. Remember to press star 6 to unmute your line.
Hi, yes, I'm Alyssa Schwernier with PRISM.
Thank you, Alyssa. Thank you. Any other media on the line? Okay, we'll move on and see if there's any government representatives or staff members on the call today. Please remember to press star 6 to unmute your line. Okay, so with that, we'll go ahead and move into our Yukon area updates. I'll ask if the Yukon River area managers from ADFNG could please introduce themselves and give their reports. If we wanted to start off with Fred West and Dina Urbani.
Good Yes, this is Bonnie here. Good afternoon. I'm a fall season research biologist from Fish and Game, and I'm going to provide the initial fall season assessment at this point. So the fall chum salmon run size projection based on the summer to fall relationship is less than 200,000 fish and is lower than last year. The average fall chum salmon run size is over 950,000 fish, and we'll be using the in-season assessment to determine the run size. As of August 4th, the cumulative catch per unit effort at Lower Yukon-Test Fish is well below average, and the midpoint of the fall chum salmon passage usually occurs around August 13th for this project. The Mainstem Yukon River Sonar Project operating near Pilot Station transitioned to fall season counts on July 19th. There's been two small groups of fish moved upriver, one on July 22nd and the other on July 31st. The latter was passing the sonar over this past weekend. The strength of each pulse has been below average, and as of August, the cumulative passage was 101,000 chum salmon. This compares to a median cumulative passage of 212,000 chum salmon for this date. The first quarter point, based on median run timing, occurs on July 30th for chum salmon in the fall season. These values include a mixture of summer and fall chum salmon, and once genetics are applied, they will effectively reduce the main stem sonar estimate number to fall chum salmon in the river. With the removal of the summer chum salmon in the estimate, the first quarter point of fall chum salmon, based on median run timing, occurs on around August 6th. So the fourth stratum of chum salmon genetics sampled from Pilot Station Sonar Test Fishery, which covers July 19th through the 30th, is in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Lab at this time, and we expect results later this week or early next week. This time period usually includes the crossover between transitioning the summer and fall chum salmon. For stock assessment, the remainder of the season, we will concentrate on the three main fall chum salmon stock groups. Group one is the Trigingic, Chingic, Grongic. Group two is the Canadian stocks, and group three is the Tanana fall stocks. The preliminary age composition, we have 79 chum salmon sampled from the strip test gillnet fishery at Lower Yukon Test Fish Project from the 16th through the 31st of July. It consisted of 69% age 4 and 31% age 5. This compares to the 2001-2024 historical average of 53% age 4 and 40% age 5. The percentage of female chum salmon from July 16th through August 3rd was 47%, which is below the historical average of 53%. The average length is 572 millimeters, and it's below the historical average of 582 millimeters. For upper fall chum salmon escapement project in Alaska, crews are on site at both Trigingic, operated by Fish and Wildlife, and the Chingic River, operated by ADF&G. They're setting up camp and their sonar equipment, and they're usually expected operations to begin around August 8th, which is like Friday, I think. The Yukon Mainstem sonar project near Eagle has an average transition date from Chinook to fall chum salmon monitoring around August 20th. Last year, the transition occurred later around August 28th, and currently they're still passing Chinook salmon. We will be using both Alaskan and Canadian assessment projects to monitor escapements, particularly relative to the drainage-wide goal, the Canadian treaty objectives for the fishing branch and the Yukon River mainstem at Eagle, as well as Alaska goals in the upper Yukon on the Trigingic, Chandler River, and the Delta River within the Tanana River drainage. Cohen salmon typically enter the Yukon River in mid-August, with the bulk of the run occurring between August 16th and the 27th at the mainstem sonar operated near Pilot Station. The mainstem sonar cumulative passage as of August 4th is approximately 11,000 coho salmon, which is above the median passage of 2,000 fish for this date. So far, the coho salmon run does not appear to be as late as it has been the last few years. However, median run timing is only at 2% of the run. So that's all I have. Now it's going to cover the management strategies for the fall season.
All right. Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, this is Matt Olson, and I'm the Yukon River Fall Season Manager for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game down in Monick. Fall season management started in the Lower River on July 16th and is continuing to progress upriver based on fall chum salmon run timing. Yeah, as Bonnie was saying, fall chum run projection and current escapement is below average and isn't likely to meet the lower end of the drainage statement goal that we would need to see, you know, to allow any directed harvest. Coho is looking, you know, like there might be a little bit of a positive right now, but we would definitely have to see a lot more fish and identify harvestable surplus before we would open up opportunity for them. As mentioned last week, due to lower run projections, we'll start the fall season close for both fall chum and coho, and the use of those 4-inch or smaller mesh gill nets and manned fish wheels for non-salmon will be on that weekend-only schedule. We have discussed that these European teleconferences and the preseason European meeting, and will only be allowed from noon Thursdays through noon Sundays. I've already announced the weekend schedule for the use of those 4-inch gill nets and manned fish wheels throughout the drainage as of yesterday, with all of 5B and District 6 announced yesterday afternoon. Currently, Chinook, chum, and coho salmon fishing is closed, and the use of 4-inch or smaller mesh gill nets and fish wheels for non-salmon are closed in the coastal district and districts 1 through 5C. Booked gears will reopen on Thursday, August 7th at noon, and will be open until noon Sunday, August 10th. We'll be open on that same noon Thursday to noon Sunday schedule until further notice. The fishing schedule announced for sub-districts 5D and for District 6 was announced yesterday. And 5D, lower middle, and sub-districts 6A and B. Chinook and chum salmon fishing is currently closed, and the retention of coho and fall chum will also be closed starting at midnight tonight. 4-inch gill nets will close at noon on Sunday, August 10th, and will reopen along with manned fish wheels for non-salmon from noon Thursday, August 14th. To noon Sunday, August 17th, and then booked gears will open on that same noon Thursday to noon Sunday schedule until further notice. Subdistrict 5D upper will close a week later on August 17th at noon, and then go to that same noon Thursday to noon Sunday schedule after that. The upper Tampa area will remain open 24/7 with 4-inch or smaller mesh gill nets until further notice. As salmon are really making their way all the way up there. But they will close for fall chum and coho retention at midnight tonight as well. That's about all I have. Thank you for listening, and we'll go to the next speaker.
Yeah, hi, this is Fred West.
Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, sorry. This is the Fred West, the summer season research biologist, and I can give a brief summer season assessment and then pass it on to Dina. But essentially, summer season is coming to a close. We've got the Chinook salmon passage is most likely past the third core point at Eagle, and we are currently tracking a little bit better than last year, but it's still going to be well below average and well below the 71,000 border passage goal. We are still monitoring the China sonar / tower, and that count is up to just over 1,000 fish, 1,042, which is well below the average of over 5,000 at this time. Summer chum is at just over 1,000 as well, 1,093, and that is below the average of 5,900. They had high water issues, but they've transitioned to sonar, so they haven't missed all that many counts. Where the salt, they are currently for Chinook, they're at 1,641, below the average of just over 7,000. And the summer chum are up to 1,904. Which is below the average at this time of 12,588, And they also had high water, but there's no sonar on that project, so they missed counts on the 31st and the 1st. And so the estimates to date should be considered a minimum. And for Eagle sonar, the actual number of fish passing the project as of yesterday was 20,436, which is below the historical cumulative average of 42,978. And that's about all I got. Oh, I guess the other thing is that there's currently in the process of doing some aerial surveys for Chinook and Chum for summer season on a couple like the Andrievsky and Koyukuk and some other areas. So, yeah, I'll pass it on to Dina.
Yeah, thanks, Fred. Yeah, this is Dina John with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I don't have much to add on the management side. Matt did a really good job of covering how it's going with the changes as we make from moving from summer season to fall season management and move into that weekend opportunity schedule with the 4-inch or smaller mesh. Yeah, I just want to thank Fred for giving the assessment update and just for kind of laying out the runs. It's unfortunate that we did see a low run of Chinook salmon this year, but it is really encouraging to see that so many of those Canadian origin Chinook salmon are apparently making it to Eagle. I really want to thank all the fishermen along the river for really helping us out by keeping gear out of the water and not trying to, trying to really help the Chinook salmon make it upriver to their spawning grounds. I think once we get through all the season numbers and the project totals for the year, it'll be really great to see, how many of those Canadian origin fish did make it back to where they need to go. For summer chum salmon, yeah, unfortunately this is, based on end of season counts, I think the second lowest counts for summer chum at Pilot Station. We do still have a few more summer chum that came in after the season cutoff, and As Fred mentioned, the aerial surveys will be taking place, so hopefully we'll get some estimates of the summer chum that maybe did go up the Andrievsky where there wasn't a project this year, and at some of the other tributaries. There's also some carcass survey work going on up in the upper river that'll be kicking off with Sportfish and some folks out of the Fairbanks office. So just really want to thank everyone for their just continued understanding and really trying to work with us as we get to these really challenging, really low runs. I know it's really hard when the runs are this low. But, kind of the best thing that we can do, I feel, as folks on the river is to help the fish that do come back make it to where they need to go. And I just really want to thank everyone for their help on that as we kind of start to wrap up projects and wrap up these calls for the season. And with that, I'll turn it over to anyone from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm not sure if Holly or Keith or Shane are online today.
Hi, everyone. This is Keith Herron with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm the assistant in-season federal manager for Yukon Fisheries. And first, thank you, Matt, Bonnie, Dina, and Fred for their updates. On the federal side, the management actions are very similar to what the state just lined out. We have announced all the fall season closures on salmon and put the 4-inch gear on that weekend only schedule for the non-salmon. I would just like to reiterate that the fall chum that are counted at Pilot Station currently, or the chum that are counted at Pilot Station currently, that 100,000, that could include a lot of summer chum salmon, and we're eager to hear those genetic updates in hopefully early next week or so to understand exactly what that fall chum component run strength is. Because I'm a little concerned that it could be like half that, so around 50,000 or even worse. So we'll be sharing that once we have that information. But I just wanted to remind everyone that there could be a lot of summer chum still in that Pilot Station count at Pilot Station. So just to understand that number could be inflated with summer chum. We are also still planning to do whitefish opportunity fishing in non-salmon areas with 6-inch set gill nets, and we plan on announcing those next week in areas that have been discussed at the preseason meetings. So please look out for those announcements for those whitefish opportunities with larger mesh gill nets. And as always, please reach out if you have any questions, if you're not getting the updates from our management team on both the state and federal side, and or if you just have any questions. My number is 907-334-5391, and we're happy to talk to anyone and get you the answers you're looking for or clarify any confusion that our news releases might cause. So thank you. I hope you have a good rest of your day, and I look forward to hearing everyone on the call today.
Thank you, Keith, and thank you to all of our ADF&G managers as well. I wanted to see if the staff from any staff from Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada is on the line and could introduce themselves. Remember to press *6 to unmute your line, even if you have the mute feature off on your mobile device.
Great. Good afternoon. This is Jacqueline Kendall. Am I coming through okay?
Yes, we can hear you, Jacqueline. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Okay, hello, everyone. I am currently the acting Yukon River Operations Manager for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and I'm going to be providing a stock assessment update in Canada, followed by a brief management update. So we'll start with the Porcupine River sonar, which is near the community of Old Crow. They began counting sonar files as of June 29th and were fully operational on both banks beginning on June 30th. So the current count of Chinook salmon passing the Porcupine sonar site is 317 fish, and that is as of August 4th, so yesterday. This is slightly higher than the 2024 estimate, but well below the project average, which is usually over 2,000. This is the 12th year of this project that's providing estimates of Chinook passage into the Canadian portion of the Porcupine River. Chum have been observed in the area, but we won't transition into assessing in-season chum passage at Porcupine probably for another week or so. DFO technicians have also traveled to Eagle, Alaska, where we provide support to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in the operation of the Eagle assessment sites, and counts have been underway since June 30th, and those were covered just a little while ago. The Big Salmon Sonar is another project that has been running since early July, actually, July 11th, with a cumulative total count of Chinook salmon of just over 980 as of August 2nd. So this is actually nearly twice the passage to date estimated last season, but again, is less than average, probably half the average. This project typically uses two sonars to assess Chinook passage, but due to some technical issues early in the season, it has only been using a single sonar for almost the entire season. There are a number of other Chinook assessment projects currently operational or beginning to be operational in Canada, and most of these are led or managed by Yukon First Nations, and updates will be provided as each progresses. I do want to pause, though, just in case there are any Yukon First Nation managers online today that want to provide updates for those projects. So I'm just going to pause for a moment just to give the opportunity, but if no one's on the line, then I can progress to provide just a bit of a brief update on some of those projects. So I'll just pause for just a moment. Okay, I'm not hearing anyone jump in, but please, if you're delayed in unmuting, then just cut me off. That's fine. The Klondike River Sonar Project has also been operational since late June, about June 26. They also experienced issues this year with one of the sonars early in the season, but are now back up and running, fully functional, with an estimated 118 Chinook to have passed as of July 30th. So that is below this date last year, which was about 184, and then well below the project average, which is just over 990. The Pelly River Sonar is also another project that is operational with sonar units deployed on both banks. Chinook salmon counts as of August 3rd are just under 2,000 compared with last year, which was just about 1,700, so a little bit more there this year, but below the 10-year average, which was just over 3,600. And final one that I'm going to talk about is the Nisutlin River Sonar, which is also online as of July 16th. So this is the furthest upstream recurring assessment project in the Yukon River drainage and is in its second full year of operation. As of August 2nd, 71 Chinook have passed that assessment site. I'm just going to move on to a bit of a Canadian management update. There has been no changes for those that have been attending these calls regularly. In terms of Chinook, DFO has closed the recreational fishery for 2025, and the current long-term closures in the commercial and domestic fisheries also remain in effect. With the forecast being so far below the rebuilding target, there will be no opportunities to harvest Chinook salmon in the First Nations subsistence fishery again for 2025. And although we are not in chum season quite yet in Canada, I'll just kind of do a little bit of a forward thought there. DFO has closed the recreational fishery for 2025, and the current long-term closures in the commercial and domestic, similar to Chinook, also remain in effect. And again, with the low forecast and more recent information on the pre-season projection, opportunities to harvest chum in the First Nations subsistence fishery are not anticipated again in 2025. So that's my update. Thank you so much for letting me talk.
Thank you, Jacqueline. Appreciate your update. Is there anyone from the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission online that wishes to report an update? Okay, is there anyone from the BBAYK group that would like to report an update? Please remember to press *6 to unmute your line. Okay, we'll move into Canada. Is there anyone from the Council of Yukon First Nations or Yukon Salmon Subcommittee on the line today?
Hey, Olivia, it's Elizabeth. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Elizabeth.
Oh, perfect. I'm with the Yukon First Nations Salmon Stewardship Alliance, which is also supported by the Council of Yukon First Nations, but a few updates of what we've been doing and supporting Yukon First Nations with. So we had our annual salmon ceremony and gathering just this last week, and then or 2 weeks ago, I guess now, and the Southern Lakes First Nations hosted a salmon day. A Little Salmon Carmax First Nation just had a salmon youth camp. And all of these use Taku River salmon sockeye because obviously there's no fishing going on here. But some of the activities that we were able to do include tanning fish skins, beading, filleting, and of course eating salmon. And other First Nation projects that are currently on the go. So Tashin Creek Weir just got put in yesterday, and I heard that they counted their first fish today. It looks like it was a male. First Nations are also flying aerials right now, counting Chinook salmon, spawning their sonar projects. There's also juvenile work and habitat work on the go. There's also some investigations going with Chinook salmon that spawn below the dam that are getting planned for right now, as well as some more walks, like stream walks for counting salmon. There's drone surveys that are getting planned, and some have been done as well, and some drone surveys for chum as well, along with carcass surveys. And I did want to highlight that if people are out doing carcasses, something we started doing the last few years is taking products of the salmon. So leaving most of the carcass there, but taking some of the skin, and some of First Nations have been tanning the skin So they can have salmon leather, even though they can't have the salmon themselves. And the other new thing that we're going to start doing is taking some of retained eggs. Oftentimes there's a few eggs left in the female. As one of the First Nation artists, she, at our last gathering, just made a paint from salmon eggs and ochre. And so we're hoping that even though without having the salmon to eat, at least we can keep some of that culture alive and some of those arts and crafts continuing without salmon. Yeah, I think other updates, being kind of warm with lots of rain in between, pretty good in this area, and a few fish have been going through the fish ladder, which is great to see lots of people commenting on that. And I just happened to stop by there today because I was down by the river and there was two hatchery. Well, one hatchery male and the other one was a male, but I'm not sure if it was hatchery or not because I couldn't see the full fish it was hiding. But it was great to see, and that's the first salmon I've got to see this year, which is always great. So thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Do we have anyone from YSSC on the call today?
Hi, Olivia. It's Taylor. How are you?
Hi, Taylor. Good. Go ahead.
Not much to update here. I was just going to do the same on the weather. We're getting, some warmer temperatures and a little bit of rain, but it's looking better. And just wanted to report that, like Elizabeth said, we are seeing Chinook pass the Whitehorse fish ladder. So very exciting. I think I read the counts were 2 female and 10 male. So hoping to see more of that.
Thanks, Taylor. Good to hear that news. So we're going to move into YRDFA's update, and we don't have any field updates for today. However, we do have some information that we wanted to provide, and we're going to take this time before community reports to do so. So as part of our solution-based strategy to these teleconferences, YRDFA wanted to take this time to address a threat that was identified during the preseason meeting of management issues and share some information about an identified solution by participants, which is co-management. We would like to begin by acknowledging that YRDFA as an organization and myself as an individual are not experts in co-management. We do not engage in any co-management agreements as we are not a tribe or a tribal organization. However, due to the nature of the conversations that have taken place, questions that have been asked by participants of this teleconference call this season, and as co-management was identified as a solution to issues with management during the 2025 preseason meeting, we wanted to share some educational information about co-management and provide some examples of co-management strategies taking place within Alaska. I also want to acknowledge that this is a lot of information that could be presented in a larger setting with visuals, and so this is just meant to be the beginning of a longer conversation. So co-management of resources involves a formal agreement between tribes and federal agencies where tribes share legal decision-making authority with federal agencies in managing public lands and resources. Examples of this include the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council, and the MOU signed between Kuskokwim Intertribal Fish Commission and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Each co-management agreement is structured differently, but at the core, each of these are examples of tribes and federal agencies working together, having an equitable seat at the table, and their thoughts on management are given equal weight in decision making. The federal government has a legal and moral obligation to protect treaty rights, lands and assets and resources. This is known as the federal trust responsibility. This includes fulfilling promises made in treaties and ensuring that tribes have a voice in decisions affecting their lands and resources. As tribes, we are sovereign nations and governments. Therefore, tribes have the power through the federal trust responsibility to request formal consultations on federal management decisions and topics. For example, NOAA and NMFS have met multiple times with Yukon tribes and tribal organizations at their request throughout the North Pacific Fishery Management Council CHUM EIS process. Co-management of resources within the framework of federal trust responsibility involves collaborative management where there is shared authority between tribes and federal agencies. Many people along the Yukon are curious as to how the Kuskokwim achieved a co-management agreement for their river and why similar efforts haven't been implemented on the Yukon. I met with Kevin Whitworth from the Kuskokwim Intertribal Fish Commission to get a better understanding of their history and how they got there. Again, I would like to remind everyone that we are simply a conduit of information for everyone. We, YRTFA, are not the experts, so if questions arise that we cannot answer, we're happy to get you in touch with someone who can, or if there are representatives from the Kuskokwim or federal managers online with insight, we would appreciate any context you can provide. Sometime between 2010 and 2012, locals on the Kuskokwim began seeing Chinook declines, and they eventually saw a crash. The Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group began meeting and were unhappy with state management for continuing to open the fishery for 24/7 fishing opportunities. Unhappy with the current management, the Kuskokwim decided to put in a special action request, or a SAR, to the Federal Subsistence Board, requesting federal management and to limit fishing to federally qualified users only, based on conservation concerns. This passed the Federal Subsistence Board, federalizing the fishery. But this was not a co-management agreement, and the tribes wanted co-management, so they drafted their own management plan and identified a plan to have their own in-season managers work collaboratively with government managers. In 2016, an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, was signed, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service formally acknowledged the Kuskokwim Intertribal Fish Commission as collaborative managers. The structure of management involves the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fish Commission's representatives, which includes 33 tribal commissioners, 7 executive council representatives, 5 in-season managers, and 2 elder advisors, who all work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Federal Refuge Manager. They hold weekly in-season meetings, work collaboratively, and have equal authority in management. The Yukon Delta Refuge Manager works as the federal agency representative. The greatest asset to co-management is the expansion of information, data, and knowledge that management is basing their decisions off of. By having tribes as equal partners, tribal input and traditional knowledge guide stewardship of resources. The Kuskokwim has made a few management decisions that have allowed them to rebuild their fishery stocks. The first is that they managed to the high end of escapement. Once co-management started, they agreed to manage to the upper end of the escapement goal for 10 years so they could rebuild the population of Chinook salmon. They were seeing smaller eggs, wanted to see harvest opportunities upriver, and see more salmon make it to the spawning grounds. They saw this as a more equitable way to harvest because more fish will get back to the spawning grounds and people upriver have the opportunity to harvest. In the last 10 years, they have met almost every year of escapement of 110,000. The second management strategy that's working for them is taking a precautionary approach to ensure spawners get upriver. The Kuskokwim realized they couldn't manage the real portion of the run based on forecasting because of unpredictability. So they take a precautionary approach to avoid the early season opener and then mid-season closures. They have early season closures when the headwater stocks enter the river, And once they feel comfortable enough to open, they provide one opener and then close. They then look at the data, pause, and determine whether or not another opener is appropriate. They use the weekly management calls to review data, hear local observations, and determine the next opener. Tribally led data and information is also integral to the successful management of the Kuskokwim. Tribes present their own data and have their own tribally led management plan, setting goals, objectives, and guidelines for making management decisions and including traditional knowledge. They take a holistic approach, looking at both Western and traditional science and data. Only about half of the river is co-managed, which is important to remember. Those are the federal portions of the river. However, this works for the most part because 80 to 90% of the harvest takes place within Yukon Delta Refuge, which is where the majority of folks live and where tribal and federal management takes place. We chose to focus on the Kuskokwim as an example as they're managing fish. However, the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council is an example that we should continue to look towards and learn from, because our fish truly are migratory. The challenge of creating a new management process that has authority over an entire migration route of salmon is a big idea. However, we've started in a good place and have examples. Looking at examples like the Kuskokwim can provide a template for the Yukon to model changes to management for the betterment of our salmon runs. This is all the information that I have for you today. It was a lot to take in, but I hope that you were able to take something from this model that has been created that we might utilize for increased tribal involvement in management. YIRTFA would like to thank Kevin Whitworth for sharing his historical knowledge with us. And we would like to ask that if you have any comments or questions related to this topic, that you share those out during your community reports. And with that, I will go ahead and begin calling out by districts for our community reports. I'm going to begin with the coastal communities of Chiviac, Hooper Bay, and Scammon Bay. If anybody's on the line from those communities and would like to speak, please remember to press *6 to unmute your line. Again, we're calling out on the coastal communities of Chiviac, Hooper Bay, and Scammon Bay for community reports. Okay, we'll move on down to District Y1, Nunum Iqua, Alaganuk, Imanuk, and Kotlik. Do we have anyone from District Y1 on the line? Please remember to press *6 to unmute your line. Okay, second call for District Y1, Nunum Iqua, Alaganuk, Imanuk, or Kotlik, or anyone from the coastal communities. Okay, we'll move into District Y2. If anyone is having issues with your mute button and can figure it out, you're welcome to speak into a district if you're from Coastal or D1 and weren't able to update. So District Y2, we have Mountain Village, Pitcas Point, St. Mary's, Pilot Station, and Marshall. Do we have anyone from those communities on the line that would like to give an update?
Yeah, hello, this is Maddie St. Mary's here, just doing your water temp report here. It's a little warm today of 62.5 up at the buoy up there. And water dropping very rapidly around here. We've had hot, muggy weather. And I don't know. No, I didn't see nobody fishing during the 4-inch openers Thursday to Sundays around here. So it was all very hot weather. So that's all I got down here. Thank you.
Thank you, Maddie. Is there anybody else from District Y2, Mountain Village, Pitcas Point, St. Mary's, or Pilot Station? Okay, we will move into District Y3. Anyone from Russian Mission, Holy Cross, or Shagaluk that's on the line today? Again, please remember to press *6 to unmute your line, even if the mute feature on your phone is turned off. Okay, we'll move into District Y4A. We have Anvik, Grayling, Calpag, Nulato, and Klaikuk. Do we have anyone from those communities on the line? Again, we are calling out for community updates from the communities of Anvik, Grayling, Calpag, Nulato, and Klaikuk. Okay, we'll move up the river, the Klaikuk River, Huslia, Hughes, Allakaket, Alatna, and Bettles. Do we have anyone from the Klaikuk River who wishes to share today? Do we have anyone from District 4 A and C, Galena or Ruby on the line? Please remember to press *6 to unmute your line. Okay, is there anyone from District Y5, A, B, C, or D on the line? We have Tanana, Rampart, Stevens Village, Beaver, Birch Creek, Fort Yukon, Chalkeetsik, Venati, Arctic Village, Circle, and Eagle. Please remember to press *6 to unmute your line. calling out any reports from District Y5, Tanana Rampart, Stevens Village, Beaver, Birch Creek, Fort Yukon, Chalkeetsik, Venati, or Arctic Village Circle, or Eagle. Please remember to press star 6 to unmute your line.
No.
Hello, we can hear you.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
This is Nathan Ellswick in Anvik, 4A, lower.
Hi, Chief. Thank you.
Yes. I'm on the turbo bridge on the computer, and I had a hard time getting off the mute there. But thanks for that very good report on the Kuskokwim River. That was very interesting to hear. And I think we should try to do something similar. It sure would be nice if we could get like a draft or something going. That way we have something for our next meeting or for maybe when you guys, the board meets again at Yardford. I think it would be a good start anyways. But I did have a question on to either this, maybe someone at ADF&G on far as the educational and ceremonial permits go. How many of those were issued? How many are going to be issued this year? And how is that project going so far?
Hi, yeah, thanks. This is Dina John with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We've just had a few requests for educational permits this year. It's a very new process. The regulations came out kind of in mid-June. And so we didn't have final regulations until those were released, and so it was kind of hard to pre-plan and start, you know, doing applications and get a process for the permits. But since the regulations were released, I think we've issued 3 or 4 educational permits. We've had a couple more requests, and so we're just kind of worked through getting, you know, kind of background information about the requests and figure out if a permit is, you know, is going to be workable or not. So ideally for an educational request, for educational permit, an interested group or community or organization reaches out to one of the fishery managers at least 15 days in advance. That's the number of days that was in the regulation that was published. And that gives us some time to get some information about the educational activities and event and to put the permit together. The permit, you know, ideally should have a pretty good kind of documented educational component, like who will be the learners at the permit, like will they, or the learners at the event, like what communities will they come from, kind of what's the scope of the event. You know, we want, obviously want to see events where it's going to be teaching a wider number of youth than like just say, you know, somebody's family or somebody, you know, really small, limited group of people. And then for the actual harvest limits, those are all in reg. The permit does cap out, and so we can't have an unlimited number of educational permits per year, but so far this year we haven't come anywhere close to those limits. Also with the educational permit, there's information that we need to be able to pass on to the troopers and other enforcement folks just to let them know what kind of fishing to expect and where. And so if they see the fishing activity, they know that there's a purpose for it. So there's that part of it that we need to kind of have identified before we issue the permit. And then while the fish are being harvested, they need to be recorded. And then after the educational camp or activity is all done, we want to get, you know, just a kind of a basic report about how many fish were harvested, how they were harvested, how they were distributed, you know, how were they shared amongst the community or with the participants. You know, just that kind of thing, just to verify that the fish were used for the purpose that was stated.
Thank you. Can you still, hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, I just had one more question. And say you guys issued a permit for some fall chum and coho for either a set net or a drift net, would they be able to use 6-inch gear on that?
Yep, yeah, typically the permit is for 6-inch mesh because that's a gear that's hopefully going to avoid larger female king salmon while still helping to really kind of target chum. Folks can also, you know, we did have some other funerary permits where folks did want to use, you know, skip nets or fish wheels or smaller gear. And so a lot of it kind of depends on what kind of fishing the group wants to do, what kind of gear they have available. For the total limit for the educational permit, so each permit can get up to 10 kings, up to 50 summer chum, up to 25 fall chum, and up to 25 coho. And then for all the educational permits combined, it can be up to 300 king salmon, and for fall chum, up to 500 fall chum and 500 coho. So there can be quite a fair number of permits that are issued. And so far, we've just been doing them on a first-come, first-served basis, just with the first few that we've had come in this year. And we'll have to see how this kind of develops over time. If we start getting many, many more applications than would exceed the quota, you know, we might have to think about how we do some sort of application process, or if we do put in, like, a preseason deadline. But that hasn't really been a concern yet so far this year.
Thank you for all the information, and that's all I have. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. That was a great question.
Thank you, Chief, and thank you, Dina. We'll see if there's anyone from District Y6, Manly Hot Springs, Minto, Nenana, and Fairbanks that wishes to give an update.
Yes, I have a question. I have a couple of questions. Jude Hensler?
Yeah, please go ahead.
I don't think anybody said what the Chinook passage at Pilot Station was. I'd like to get that number. No? Nobody knows? Hello?
Do we have anyone?
No, sorry, I was waiting for Fred to chime in. Fred, I don't know if you're on with the current Pilot Station number. It would take me a second to pull it up.
This is Holly Carroll with Fish and Wildlife Service. I glanced at the numbers today, and it was about 60,000 this season for Chinook at Pilot.
60,000?
Yeah, 60,289 is the estimate. It's got a confidence interval around that, of course.
Okay, and I don't know if I copied it right for the Eagle sonar, 20,426.
But yeah, 20,436 was just published in the weekly update.
Okay.
for Eagle County.
Okay, and then if anybody's on from Fisheries and Oceans, does that number usually the number at Eagle sonar, does it usually resemble anything like what you see on the spawning grounds? Is there any verification of or the the verification of the Eagle sonar passage.
Hi, yeah, this is Jacqueline Kendall with Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Am I coming through okay?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm unfortunately my senior biologist who's in the area isn't on the call today, but spawning is really quite spread out throughout the Canadian portions of the Yukon River drainage within Canada. I may actually Elizabeth is on the line just see if you have any comments that you want to indicate in terms of having walked the area a little bit more frequently in terms of what you've seen. Elizabeth, sorry.
Yeah, I'll do my best. Thanks, Jacqueline. I would say generally there is a trend, but acknowledging that once they cross the border, they spread out quite considerably. So there's about 100 spawning locations on the Canadian side. So obviously we can't monitor them all. When there's better years, there's usually more Chinook on the spawning grounds for sure. And then I haven't been on too many chum spawning grounds, so I wouldn't want to comment, but I suspect it would be similar. But acknowledging they're really spread out. And, but definitely when I talk to First Nation elders, too, they talk about when the numbers were better, how much more fish they saw on the spawning grounds compared to now. So I definitely think there is a good correlation, I guess you'd say, but maybe each stock might do a little bit better. Like we see Pelly – for some reason, the ones that go Pelly seem to always do a little bit better than the ones on the headwater areas as well.
Is there ever a publicized a number for escapement, a total for escapement? I can imagine it's not hard for me to realize how complicated it is to get all those streams and all those side streams. I just wonder if a number, but does a number get published, or are we shooting in the dark?
Oh, no, there's definitely numbers published. So even in the daily emails that ADF&G sends out, quite a few of the counts there are in Canada. And then in the Joint Technical Committee's publication every year, those are recorded. So we got in the ADF&G one that gets sent out, we've got Upper Porcupine, Klondike, Pelly, Big Salmon, the Whitehorse Fish Ladder Dam, Nisqually River, and these are the ones that where you get daily counts, but there's also a lot of aerial surveys that might be a one-time event that are in the JTC report, or red counts are often done, or stream walks as well, and the most of that data ends up into the Joint Technical Committee reports as well. But there aren't usually spawning goals for each of those systems. So it's a little bit different. The goal is kind of at the border and estimated from there for the main salmon and the porcupine. There isn't one on that one, so it's not included for Chinook. But all that data is there if you ever want to look at it. And ADF&G's website is really good. They have a lot of the Canadian data up as well. So it's pretty easy to find if you want it.
Okay, thank you.
It's Jacqueline Kendall again.
I have one more question. Is there any kind of projection of how long it's maybe the geneticist would give us some idea of how long they is anticipated to rebuild the Yukon stock of Chinook and Chum?
This is Holly Carroll, Fish and Wildlife Service, and I'm hearing a lot of nothing there, and I think that's because there's probably not a single agency staff person who could tell you that anybody's been able to do that, that there is not a particular method that I know of using genetics or otherwise to determine how long it would take to rebuild these stocks. I know different complex modeling has been done on various stocks. There was a Canadian scientist who did some studies modeling long-term effects of various sizes of returns. But I don't think we have a set number on how long it will take to rebuild stocks and or whether we would be able to achieve stock rebuilding to the sizes we've seen in the past. So that's a really complicated final question you asked there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I could add that just last year, this last winter, a Canadian scientist has been working on it, not just one, but several, and they're not through the genetics, but the modeling approach that Holly mentioned, and the preliminary stuff is saying about 50 years. And it'll change a little bit depending if there's more fishing or less fishing, and depending what you run through the model, but it is a model. So it's limited to what it can say, but I thought I'd share the 50 years just in case that was helpful.
Okay, thank you.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Did I miss the meeting?
No, not quite. We're still here.
Oh, okay.
Would you like to give a community update? Okay, well, we were on District Y6. I will give a short update from Nenana. This week, Nenana Native Council is holding the annual culture camp down here on the banks of the Tanana River, where we have a 5-day camp Monday through Friday. And we'll be holding a potlatch on Saturday. Our kids were really, really excited to get in the boat yesterday on the first day. And we received the village of Nenana received an education permit from the state. So nets were put out yesterday, and they'll be checked. I believe the kids are actually checking them now. So we were really grateful to be afforded that that opportunity, and hope that there's other communities and events and camps such as ours that will be receiving these permits. So that's my update from Nenana. Was there anybody else from District Y6, Manly Hot Springs, Minto, or Fairbanks that wanted to provide
a community? Hello, Victor.
Yeah, go ahead, Uncle.
Yeah, I'm sitting here at Fish Camp. Charlie's ready to cut some fish over there. And Eva and busy boys are stringing out a rope because I can get set another net there. But boats are going back and forth. Three different boats. People have been eating. Tank family here. Vanell Tides is there. It's a bunch of good to see people moving out on the Tan River Bank again. Tribal land here. So that's good, and hope things are going good to all my brothers and sisters downriver and up the river. Over and out.
Thank you, Duke. Okay, we'll move into our Canadian relatives. Is there anybody from Old Crow, Dawson, Whitehorse, Pelly Crossing, Mayo, CarMax, or Teslin on the line? Okay, and was there anybody from any of our communities or districts that wasn't able to provide an update or a report out that wishes to? Please remember to press *6 to unmute your line, even if your mute button on your phone is deactivated. Okay, we'll now just open the floor for any discussion. Is there anybody that has comments or questions today or anything they would like to bring up for discussion during our teleconference?
Hello, Nicholas Victor here from Marshall District Y2. Did somebody do a report on Y2 today?
We had someone just from St. Mary's, but we haven't had one from Marshall.
Oh, yeah. I've been hearing, low Baltimore numbers, so hardly anybody's been out fishing. The people who have 4-inch nets are not catching very much on the, for the Baltimore or Coho. Wondering how was Y1 or Y1 doing?
Is there any management on the line that could give an update on how District Y1 is, how those runs are looking when they're coming in?
Hi, this is Matt with Fish and Game. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Matt. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, sorry. It took me a second to get unmuted there. Yeah, so things are really slow in the lower river. You know, obviously we're still doing the lower Yukon test fishery right now, and you know, going out you know, morning and afternoon to fish, or to test fish Big Eddy and Middle Mouth whenever the weather allows us to. Catches have been really slow. Usually it's just a fish here or a couple fish there. But we have seen a few, you know, a few catches where, you know, we've caught 10 to 15 plus. It's really small, you know, given perspective. But yeah, the short answer is that there's really not a lot of fish in the river. We're hoping to see, you know, better coho numbers. Still very, very early on the coho. Hopefully there'll be some more there. But yeah, the short answer is there, things are very slow and there's not a lot of river. Yeah,
this is Holly Carroll with Fish and Wildlife, and I misheard the gentleman, but I guess what I wanted to kind of remind folks is, you know, if you're not catching fall chum and coho in your 4-inch, that's good. That's what we want. We don't actually want people targeting salmon in their 4-inch. The runs are so poor, that's one of the reasons you're not catching them in 4-inch. But it's also really important that because the runs are so poor, that we actually let all the salmon go by. And so if you start to catch good salmon in your 4-inch, it's time to move your 4-inch to somewhere else where you're more likely to get whitefish instead of salmon. So I really hope that, you know, maybe I'm misunderstanding your question and it was about the assessment, but I just want to really make sure that we're all in this together and that you understand that the reason we've got fishing limited to the weekends is because we do want people to be able to get whitefish, but we hope that people are not using their 4-inch to get salmon. So hopefully that clarifies our management actions that are in place right now.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, even the you know, people here are not really targeting salmon there because they understand that the numbers are so low, but sometimes once in a while they'll catch, you know, if there's big runs, they'll catch at least one, even if they're not targeting them. But that's what I was pertaining to. So there's nobody, you know, 4-inching on the river, they're being fixed and lose stuff like that.
Thank you, Nicholas. Okay, we are in the open discussion period. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment or ask any questions or bring up anything at this time?
Good afternoon. This is David Walker in Holy Cross.
Yeah, go ahead.
Is this the last meeting or the next week?
Next week.
Okay. I had a little concern about earlier this summer. A game warden friend of mine, he stopped by and I was discussing with him about 4-inch. And I told him I have to be off the mainstream to set the 4-inch. And he told me twice, or he even pulled up the regulation and he said, oh no, you could set it anywhere you want, he told me. And so there's some, he's a good guy, but there's some contradiction there on what you're saying today. Anybody could clarify that?
Hi, Dave. I'll just add a little bit, and maybe Holly can add a little bit more. But yeah, so the trooper was correct. So in summer season, you could set your 4-inch or smaller mesh nets anywhere that you wanted to. We did highly encourage and request and ask folks that you set them where you know that you're going to get non-salmon. And so, you know, typically that is going to be a side stream or a slough or a tributary. So you could set your net in the main stem, but we really encourage folks to not do that and to put their nets into areas where they would just anticipate catching non-salmon. We just really rely on folks to use their traditional knowledge and their best judgment to really try to target those fish and to not put their nets in areas where they're going to intercept salmon. Things are going to be a little bit different for the fall season, and Holly and Matt can talk a little bit more about fishing opportunities that are not on the main stem, but in summer season, you could set those 4-inch nets, in the main stem or any waters that you thought were appropriate for targeting non-salmon.
Yeah, hi, this is Matt Olson with Fishing Game. So during the fall season, we're on that weekend schedule right now. So 4-inch gill nets and manfish wheels can be used to target non-salmon from noon Thursdays until noon on Sundays. And those gill nets can be put in the main stem or inside sloughs as well. So again, like Gina was just mentioning, we're asking folks to obviously to target whitefish and other non-salmon species, and to set those gill nets in areas where you're not going to catch salmon. All the salmon are closed right now. So later on in the season, as Keith mentioned earlier, we're going to have those extra 6-inch opportunities in those identified non-salmon spawning areas off the main stem. And those will obviously be just off the main stem, not in the main stem. But that weekend schedule for 4-inch or smaller, the manned fish wheels, those can go anywhere. Hope that answers your question or clears up a bit.
Yes, thank you. One more, just a comment and what I think about the education permit. To me, it's a little bit extensive into like the tribal council or whatever, having culture camp, that they're not trustworthy. To me, those answers we got to give after the fact is a little extensive to me. Thank you.
Hi, yeah, and thanks for those comments. And it's definitely an evolving process, just in reg. It is pretty broad as to what it can be. It can be, community or an organization or a village or a tribe or a household. And then there's not a lot of stipulations. We've just tried to kind of put forth stipulations just to help us as we're issuing these permits know that an event, has staff, has educators, has funding, is actually going to happen. Because, we might get into situations next year where these permits are limited or where we do bump up against the harvest limit. So we do really want to make sure that they go to groups that are really going to do like a really good kind of quality educational experience. And I don't know, I guess maybe if anyone who has received a permit wants to chime in about how the process was and how they felt it worked out, that might be helpful. But we're definitely kind of, it's a new process. It's a very new permit. We're definitely kind of working through what should be required and what makes sense as we're issuing these.
Okay, look like nobody that got a permit's going to share. Okay, thank you. Hope you all have a good week.
Hello, can you guys hear me all right, Olivia?
Yes, we can hear you, Chief.
I guess I have a comment. I guess it's not really a question. That goes to hearing what they're just saying. I mean, I'm all for the permits just because we along the river, we haven't had any opportunity in many, many years now. So I'm all for the permits. Hearing the numbers is that the management was just talking about the numbers are so low, we shouldn't be targeting salmon and stuff like that. It almost, I mean, I guess our, to me, it makes us kind of, we're the bad people again, so maybe our relatives up in Canada, they might be looking, they're looking for some people that are fishing on the Yukon River with permits, and it, I mean, I'm all for it, but at the same time, it just, it kind of does make it, then our people in Canada are probably thinking that, putting more blame on us when the real problem is probably what's going on with the mismanagement of ADF&G in Area M and what's going on in the North Pacific. So, and those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Chief Nathan. Is there anybody else on the line who wishes to share any comments or concerns? Please remember to press star 6 to unmute your line.
Hey, Olivia, I can share a Canadian perspective on what was just shared about the cultural harvest.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think your concerns for the Canadian side holds true, and that's definitely something I've heard even last year when there was no cultural harvest opportunities was, well, Alaskans are still getting a lot of fish in the river and out in the bycatch in the ocean as well, obviously, and I'm not looking forward to going to tell Canadians that Alaskans had the opportunity for a cultural harvest this year, because I know Canadians are not going to be happy with that. And I know it's in the 7-year agreement and Canada has the same right to have a harvest, but thinking of like Tez and Klinka Council and thinking of my friends who came to me and said, well, we wanted to have a Chinook for a potlatch, and I had to tell my elders no because there weren't enough fish. We couldn't do that. Or my friend who was dying wanted a last taste of a Chinook, and there was none in the community. Or there was, or no, we just couldn't do it because it wasn't appropriate. And they've got 30 years of that. And then to hear that Alaskans aren't going to make the same sacrifices, it's really... it's heartbreaking for a lot of Canadians. And that doesn't mean Canadians, there are Canadians too who want a cultural harvest. Well, all Canadians want a cultural harvest or more of a harvest, but just looking at what the numbers are and how bad things are, it's not appropriate right now. It's pretty, by and large, the Canadian thoughts on it. And so it is really hard to hear when numbers are so bad, and it really does speak to having fairness along the river and having those conversations and making decisions together. So not just like a co-management, but with Canadians as well, because it's affecting us. Every fish you take out of the river down there is one less fish that'll reach the spawning grounds. And a lot of those are headed into Canada. So yeah, just, I wanted to share that because I feel like if I didn't, I'd get in trouble. And I'm going to Pelly Crosby next week, and I'm going to be talking to people who live along the river and subsistence fish or First Nations and fish. And they uphold like wanting fish so bad and being out there with their families. And they're choosing not to do that because of the numbers. And they'd get mad at me if I didn't share. So I just wanted to share. So thank you.
Thank you for sharing that, Elizabeth.
Can I share something? This is Holly Carroll at Fish and Wildlife Service. And, you know, I also have some concerns about the permits. We sometimes, when we issue our memorial or funerary potlatch permits or these educational permits, we get calls from other members of the community who are just concerned that there might be abuse. And we're really careful with that. And we really are trying to help preserve some form of Alaskan religious, spiritual, traditional practices in very minimal forms. So far, it hasn't been a problem, but we do need to watch that. We need to see if these requests go forward. But I also wanted to highlight that there are some communities that are holding culture camps, and they're choosing not to use salmon for these very reasons. So recently we did hear from Eagle, and they're holding a culture camp, and they are choosing to only use whitefish and legal 4-inch gear means to get that. So, you know, there are a lot of communities out there finding other ways to get people together and practice their culture. And I just want to thank everyone for the sacrifices they're making, the changes they're making to their lifestyle and their, you know, hundreds of years old practices. It is hard on everyone, and it does affect everyone differently. And so I just want to thank everyone for having some grace and compassion with each other. Thank you.
Hello. Hello, Victor.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Duke.
I just wanted to chime in on the you know, the educational permit, the one that they passed this summer. I think it's a great thing. I think just fishing with a 4-inch net, everybody's got to take, try to be responsible when you're just out there fishing with your net. Like how I say, you're catching too much salmon, pull the net, move it, you know. But people that are fishing for a death of someone, this chance to get a couple fish is a big thing. It's part of public. If that family and friends get together and they work together and they process the fish together, or and the kid, and also the kids, when you set a net, that's the whole complete thing for them. They go out and jump in the boat like they did this morning. They jump in the boat. They see that net getting checked. They're amazed. They've never seen it before. And that's what we're missing. That's what disappears from the whole doggone culture. So, I'm sorry. There is no Canadians up there for me, but I'm sorry, you guys. It's a tough call. You can't even call my fish right. We don't know how much fish are going up the Chena River. We don't know how much fish are going up the Salt River because we're not sure. So the best comment were the fish rules and the nests when people reported them. Okay, I'm fired up a little bit, but thank you.
How you doing, dude? Doing okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Duke, and thank you to everyone who's been willing to engage in this conversation. I think it was appropriate and admirable for Chief Nathan to address the feelings that many folks are feeling along both sides of the river, and acknowledging the Canadian relatives that have been sacrificing for so many years. This is, as it always has been, a learning curve and learning lesson on how we manage such a large river system with so many different stocks. And I appreciate Elizabeth's inclusion comment about inclusion of our Canadian relatives and governments in management strategies such as co-management. There are some platforms that exist that we utilize between our two management systems, but obviously we're still finding what strategies are best. So I appreciate everybody being willing to engage in that conversation and be vulnerable. It's important for us to be able to speak to each other in a truthful way with kindness so that we can continue to work together. Any other comments? Any other comments or questions that have arose for anyone?
Hi, Olivia. This is Brooke Woods from Rampart. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead, Brooke.
I just have some general comments I wanted to share and some concerns, and I appreciate all the conversation throughout the summer. As the fall chum and coho runs are expected to be below average, subsistence fishing will be restricted in river as they swim through each community or district. And non-salmon fishing will be reduced to protect migrating salmon when there is no protection in the Bering Sea within the jurisdiction of federal and state fisheries and competition from hatchery production. When Yukon River tribes are able to co-manage, we will see a restoration of salmon populations and subsistence opportunity. The continued escapement and treaty obligations that are being failed, ANS that has not been met, and subsistence is still not being prioritized, which is a hardship for both Alaska Native people and managers alike. And I just wanted to share the importance of salmon to the health and well-being of our community members. In a report by the state in 2017 on vitamin D, stated that it is an essential vitamin that is produced by in the skin from sunlight and naturally in some foods such as oily fish like salmon. Vitamin D is best known for promoting bone health and maintaining adequate levels of calcium and phosphorus to ensure proper bone metabolism. Vitamin D deficiency is known to cause bone disorders, and a decline in traditional diets, including wild salmon, has been linked to a rise in vitamin D deficiency, particularly in Alaska Natives in the younger generation. With the big, beautiful bill, which is proposing cuts to SNAP and Medicaid, nearly 70,000 Alaskans rely on SNAP, and 1 in 3 use Medicaid. These cuts would worsen food insecurity in remote Alaska, where steady jobs vary and affordable commercial food is limited or does not exist. And last week, I think I shared if you were to replace subsistence food, it would be $100 to $300 million dollars. And for the ceremonial potlatch permit, please incorporate end-of-life care for those who choose to go home to their home village and are craving their traditional foods for their journey and to provide spiritual protection to the loved one and their family. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke. Floor is still open. Please remember to press *6 to unmute your line if you wish to speak.
Olivia, it's Nathan again. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please go ahead, Chief Nathan.
So, going back, how long would something like that take to get something in place for the Yukon, and how long did it take on the Kuskokwim? I think we really got to start looking at these issues like yesterday, because we're already way behind, so it would be good to start having these discussions sooner the better, so we could try to get something in place.
Yeah, it's a great question, Chief, and you know, this is, as we mentioned, it's an ongoing conversation that has a lot of nuances within it, and each of those councils and co-management agreements that were created were all a little bit different. With the Kuskokwim, from the history that I was shared with, again, I'm welcoming anyone on the line who has any additional historical knowledge of the MOU process between Cusco and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to please chime in. But as I understand it, their efforts began around 2012, and the MOU was successfully signed in 2016. So that took them about 4 years. I'm not sure if there were historic efforts made by local communities prior that had built, you know, more of a solid foundation for that. But from the time that they submitted that special action request and for federal management to the point where they signed the MOU, it was about 4 years. You know, something to keep in mind about that river system
that just kind of exemplifies the difficulty of us doing it on the Yukon, is the one thing is the apportionment of federal management and jurisdiction on that river. So as I mentioned, only about half the river is actually managed federal, co-managed between Kuskokwim and the federal managers. But how that works is that about 80 to 90% of the harvest takes place in that Yukon Delta refuge area, where a hefty amount of the population live there. And so because they were able to manage federal waters and lands downriver, they were able to make that effect go upriver, if even into waters that they couldn't manage. The Yukon River is much larger than the Kuskokwim River. It's also much more checkerboarded in terms of jurisdiction. At any point, as I understand it, the federal manager can it can request or assume authority of federal areas and waters, and I would love it if there's any insight that Holly has to add into the conversation too on that side as the federal manager. But those are a few of, you know, those are a few of the difficulties. And then our salmon obviously also go and migrate not just out into the Norton Sound, but then they go all the way down, you know, past the area of where Bristol Bay is, all the way down to the peninsula and then into the Gulf. And so that migration route for Yukon users to desire a management strategy that involves that migratory journey of the salmon would look different than just a strict MOU signing between Yukon River tribes and the federal manager. So I think that what a lot of folks on this call are considering and thinking about is some sort of management strategy that can have authority over the Yukon salmon throughout their entire life journey. And that would be looking at both the Kuskokwim as an example of co-management, but then also looking at the Migratory Bird Co-Management Council potentially as a structure for a migratory type council. So that's what I have to add, and I'm would be happy if there's anybody else who wishes to add in anything.
Yeah, this is Holly Carroll, Fish and Wildlife Service, and Olivia, you know, is really an expert on kind of this broader concept of how do we add in the responsible management of our fish once they leave our drainage and go into the oceans, and that's definitely the piece that no one is doing. I mean, Fish Commission on the Kuskokwim is also not managing that piece. But they actually have really good staff that give wonderful presentations updating us on the sort of bycatch that occurs in the marine environment, and they also have a lot of advocacy in that area. And we're seeing a lot of advocacy in that area from our stakeholder groups on the Yukon. But one thing I kind of wanted to highlight that I'm kind of surprised hasn't been mentioned, and it's also weird timing that the Yukon River Fish Commission is not on today. They are on most of these calls. And, you know, they have actually been working off and on for years to try to create a system like the Kuskokwim system, a system of co-management, a system that strives to unify the river and help to manage the river. And they have, you know, been very involved in the past. They went to the Board of Fisheries and they helped pass some regulatory laws that we're working with today. I think they're going through a phase where they're pulling out from under Tanana Chiefs, and they've become a nonprofit. I think they have a lot of tribes involved. And so it's a shame that they weren't here today to kind of give an update on what they're working on and ways to engage with them on this, because I do think that, like the Kuskokwim,
you need representation from all parts of the river to be successful with co-management. And I think that's what the Kuskokwim has done really well. They have most of the areas well represented on that commission. And that's what we would need. So, yeah, I hope they'll be on maybe the next call and that people will get in touch with them if they don't know about the Fish Commission, and just kind of work more directly with them on ways they see that we could improve co-management on the Yukon.
Hello, Olivia. It's Nathan again. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah. Thanks, Nathan. Go ahead.
I guess one final thing, and the reason I'm glad to hear on some stuff on the co-management, and the reason I brought it up was I'm sure a lot of people are aware or read the article that was just put on ADN not too long ago about the what they say about the mismanagement with the overhaul. I'm not too sure if any of the managers there in the room want to speak on that article that was posted in ADN last week or the other week.
Yeah, hi Nathan. Sorry, this is Dina John with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Yeah, it was definitely an interesting article and something I kind of have to really think through and digest. You know, I think a lot of just as an in-season manager, I'm kind of limited in my scope and also limited in my focus. Like, I'm always kind of like laser focused on a couple things, like meeting escapement goals, and then if there's more fish than escapement goals, providing opportunity. And so that's really been my role, and it's kind of constrained by, you know, the escapement goals that we have and the run sizes that we have. You know, and we usually are always hearing from fishermen that if there's fish, they want to go fish for them. And I want people to fish for them if there's enough fish. And so, that's kind of my role and that's kind of my focus. And so if there's things that happen outside the river, things that go on in the ocean, things that go on in Area M, those are hugely important and hugely impactful. And I really hope that, you know, we can get a better understanding of how many fish are being intercepted in Area M and how to, you know, maybe have a migratory corridor along the coast. You know, those would all be really great things to understand. Also, you know, what's happening to our fish in the ocean? Are they coming back healthy enough to spawn successfully to make these long spawning migrations? You know, so that's, it was an interesting article, and it would definitely be interesting to kind of look more at how we manage fish holistically, but it's just, it is really big and does really extend beyond what takes place in the river.
Thank you.
Thank you. And is there anyone else who wishes to bring anything up today before we get off the call?
Yeah, good morning, this is David Walker again. I didn't mean, intend to sound like I'm knocking the permits, but yeah, it sounds like their permits are off the mainstream, like Tanner or Ninana, that's not even on the Yukon going up to Canada. So I just hope that the Canadians don't think we're finding ways to fish. And because if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, one manager is that 35% of the salmon only go to Canada, and we have many other contributaries that these permits could be issued to. And that's another thing. I wonder if that number changed since the drastic downfall in salmon. Do you know how much percent still going to Canada? I guess that would be my question.
Hi, yeah, this is Dina with Fishing Game. Unfortunately, my speaker cut out, so I missed some of your question. But as to the educational permits in the Tanana River, yeah, that it's definitely it's kind of related to the seven-year agreement, but the regulation was written broadly enough to just cover the Yukon area. So when we have conservation concerns and when subsistence fishing is closed and when folks don't have any other opportunities or ways to fish, you know, as they would normally, then that's when this educational permit can kind of come in and be, you know, this one little tiny opportunity, you know, in the face of these other conservation measures. And that's why it's that's why it was issued for the Tanana River, because their runs are also low. Kind of the stocks of Chinook salmon are low, not just in Canada, but throughout a lot of all the tributaries in Alaska, and we're not meeting escapement goals. And so this is a very small, very limited harvest opportunity. And then unfortunately, I think I missed what the other part of your question was.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, that 35% of the salmon go to Canada. I don't know if that percentage has changed since our drastic decline in our stocks on both sides of the border.
Yeah, I don't know if Fred West is still on, if he can speak to the Canadian percentage over the last few years.
Yeah, hi, this is Fred, research with Fish and Game. It's the average the last couple of years, it's been around 45%. It varies, but it used to be way back in the day, you know, we thought it was about 50%, but then over the years it's kind of fluctuated, but currently it's about 45%.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, I would like to remind everyone that this is just one of many platforms that exists to participate in conversations about our salmon and the management of the resources. we do have another conference call next week at 1 p.m. We will be discussing some of those additional threats and solutions that were identified during our 2025 preseason meeting. I would like to acknowledge the gravity of the conversation that we had today. I thank everyone for sharing their comments in a good way and being able to participate in this difficult conversation. I also wanted to mention that the Fish Commission is generally on the line. I know that the normal representative is traveling right now, and so but as Holly mentioned, the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission is really the platform that much of this kind of type of work would be carried out on. And so YIRTFA is a continuing collaborative partner with the Fish Commission, as well as multiple organizations from throughout the interior. And so these conversations can continue. And you can always also find information to get in touch with the Yukon River Intertribal Fish Commission on their website and their Facebook page, I know. So I would just like to thank everyone for joining us for our ninth call of the season. I appreciate all of those of you who have been sticking with us and have been on all of our calls, and thank you to those who are newly joining us today. We appreciate all of the comments that you brought to us and look forward to seeing you next week. Take care, everyone.
Thanks, Lydia.
When is the fall season ending?
I'm sorry, this is Matt with hello, this is Matt with Fishing Game. Could you repeat your question?
I was just wondering, when's the fall season ending? Like what's the date for the wrap up for the season?
Yeah. So thank you for your question there. So if you could remind me where you're at, the dates will start rolling up river in early October. Typically when the fall season kind of management actions start relaxing back to their overwinter defaults. So likely starting in early October is the general answer in the lower river, and then working their way up river from there.
Oh yeah, I'm from Marshall. So this is Nicholas. Yeah. And so early October is the projection for this year's season end for the lower Yukon area?
Yeah, I don't have the date off the top of my head right now, but yeah, typically like last year, it'll start in early October, and that's typically when all of the fall chum will have passed through that area, and so we can start relaxing back to the overwinter kind of defaults where we go back to, you know, the 7.5-inch mesh maximum for gillnets and no extra restrictions there. Because we don't have any concerns for bycatch of salmon at that point.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the room now since we've gone ahead and ended for the day. We look forward to seeing you all next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Thank you, Matt, for staying on.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
No problem. Thanks.